You're listening to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The Vancouver Police Department has one of the largest police dog squads in Canada. They are trained to bite and hold when ordered to stop a suspect. As a result, for the past 2 years, an average of 5 people a month have been bitten badly enough that they need to go to emergency. Pivot Legal Society says this number is far too high, and that the Vancouver Police needs to review their police dog practice. Last month, Pivot Legal launched a civil suit against the Vancouver Police Department on behalf of Christopher Evans. Evans was bitten after attacking a bus and needed 100 staples to close wounds in his leg. Douglas King is a lawyer with Pivot Legal's policing campaign. He joins us by phone this morning. Hello, Doug.
Hi, good morning.
What happened to Christopher Evans that led him to be bitten by the police dog?
Yeah, what happened with Chris was a relatively normal thing, I guess, in our society. Not anything that we want to see, but Chris was in a situation where he was trying to catch a bus home. A few buses passed him by, and he kind of lashed out at one of the buses that passed by, causing one of the windows to be broken. So, and he admits that obviously that was not the right behavior and that he committed a criminal offense. As a result, police were called. One of the other passengers on the bus called the police, and they showed up. By the time they arrived, Chris had already left. He'd already just started making his way home, and that's when the officer with the police dog found Chris and deployed the dog against him.
And he ended up with 100 staples to close a wound on his leg.
Right. So there's a little bit of a discrepancy on what the both sides say, but Chris says that when he was on his skateboard and he was going down the alleyway towards his house in the downtown east side, and the first thing that he noticed or kind of heard was actually the dog making contact with his leg. So he wasn't given any direction, but he heard. He had his headphones in. He didn't see any sirens. He didn't hear anything, and basically it went immediately towards the use of force of the dog. The police say that they gave him a warning and that the police car itself should have been visible, but they also recognize that or admit that they were behind Christopher when this happened, so they weren't in front of him. And the independent witness reports actually suggest that Christopher was on his skateboard and he wasn't running away like the police say. So there's this issue about whether or not he was fleeing, but what we're basically saying in this lawsuit and what we've been saying all along is even if somebody is fleeing or hiding from the police, the way that police dogs have been deployed, it's almost a foregone conclusion that they're going to bite somebody, that they're going to send them to hospital, and there really needs to be an evaluation of whether or not that's an appropriate use of force, because in Mr. Evans' case, he really was bitten within an inch of his life. The nurses at the hospital said if the dog had basically been over less than an inch, he probably would have hit his main artery in his leg, and he would have bled out and died on the street.
I do want to get further into that method and the deeper story, but first there's two other cases that you've come across recently. One was a youth in Surrey, and the other was a man named Scott Filippo. What happened to them both?
Right. So actually the same weekend that we announced that we were doing a civil suit on behalf of Mr. Evans to challenge the use of force of police dogs, there's a separate story that came out in Surrey regarding a young man, I think he was 16-year-old, who had or was suspected of shoplifting, or actually I think breaking into a convenience store and taking some energy drinks. So the Surrey police attended at the scene, and a member of the dog squad located the boy and released a dog. That dog made contact with him and actually started biting him in his face. So there were pictures that were released that showed, you know, these bite marks basically right in between his eyes. The force of the bite broke his nose and caused some pretty significant and pretty brutal scarring. So there was this issue being raised in Surrey at the exact same time it was being raised in Vancouver, and I think those two things combined with the reaction of the Vancouver Police Department really pushed this issue of dog bites out into the world and made it a talking point, not just in BC, but you know, obviously the RCMP has dog squads across the country. So when we put ourselves out into the world with Mr. Evans' case, and we really promoted it in a sense, you know, we thought it was going to be an issue that was really seen as Vancouver, and obviously what we realize now is this is a national issue that needs to be addressed. And In addition to those cases, one of the first cases that we put forward was this individual, Scott Filippo. He came to us in the summer of this last year, and he was essentially in a position where he was suspected of stealing a bicycle. That bike actually turned out to be his own bike, so he was innocent. And he was arrested for whatever reason by an officer with a police dog. The officer couldn't control the police dog, and the dog accidentally bit him in his torso. So that was the first case that we put out there into the world and saying, why are officers with police dogs making arrests when they don't have to be? Why are these dogs biting so many people, and why are so many people going to hospital? And the only reaction we've gotten from the Vancouver Police Department really is just, this is the way it's been done since the 50s. We have the oldest dog squad, and nothing you say is going to change the way that we train our dogs.
And so what is the way it's been done since the 50s? What is it about the way they train their dogs that lead to these kinds of injuries?
It's kind of an older school way of training, I guess you could say. It's called the bite and hold method, and Vancouver's always used the bite and hold since they started the dog squad in the 50s. And to me that was one of the first red flags. If you're talking about a method of training or a police practice that's been around for 50 or 60 years, it means either it's time-honored and tested and there's probably nothing wrong with it, or maybe there hasn't been kind of this movement towards progression. Usually what happens with policing is it has to change as society changes. And so that was one thing that really kind of sparked my interest, is we're using the same deployment of police dogs that we did, at a time when civil rights abuses were a huge issue in society. There's a lot of records that suggest that police dogs were commonly used to break up civil rights protests in the States, and kind of the way that they were trained and have been used is really very adversarial, and it's all designed about whenever a dog is deployed, it's taught to do one thing and one thing alone, and that's to bite the suspect. You can teach the dog to bite the suspect in a certain place, and ideally that bite is supposed to be held, so there's not supposed to be multiple bites. But, of all the cases that we've seen, we're seeing a lot of dogs making multiple bites. We're seeing them bite in places like this boy in Surrey in the head where they're not supposed to. And that really made us think, well, is this the only way that dogs can be used? And really quickly, it really pointed out to us, and some of the research that we saw, a lot of the movement that we saw in the States because of the civil rights abuses suggested that this is a bit of an antiquated way of training. There's other ways to do it that reduce the amount of hospitalizations, and that maybe it's time for us to review our practices.
What are the other ways that some police forces have changed their practice?
I'm going to be totally honest and say, obviously, I've never trained dogs myself, and this is all based as a lawyer doing legal research and also doing kind of just general research on the suspect. My understanding is that there are other methods of training. One of them is called bark and hold, which has been employed in some departments in the States, where instead of making first contact and biting an individual, the dog will first try to stop them or to get them to gain compliance just by their presence and by barking at them. I don't know whether or not that's the most kind of recent and most effective way of training. My understanding from talking to other people is that there's also other ways to train the dogs, which are kind of a hybrid of the two. And I think there's a lot of debate out there about what's best, which is a good thing. You want to see debate happening about what policy is the most effective, which keeps officers safe, but also preserves the human rights and the dignity of the people that are suspected of committing crimes. And obviously the key is that they're suspected of committing crimes. Force should never be used as a foregone conclusion, assuming that the person is guilty. That's what the justice system is for. Police are there to apprehend. They're not there to punish. So it's been an interesting kind of ride trying to figure out what's the best, and really what we've been doing over the last month, over the last 2 years, to be honest, is trying to engage with as many departments as possible, try to get a sense out there for what different methods of training are out there and whether or not it's time that we made a switch.
Have you come across any departments in the area that would serve as a better model to look to?
So just recently, actually, just last week, we made kind of an interesting discovery, and I don't know entirely what the circumstances are, but we've gotten an indication that the New West Police Department, which runs an integrated dog squad along with Delta, does do a different method of training than what's called the bark and or the bite and hold. Surrey RCMP, actually all RCMP across Canada, and Vancouver Police Department and Abbotsford, they all use the bite and hold method, and the statistics that we've seen suggest that it's it's clear that that method leads to a very high number of hospitalizations, the way that the departments have been using their dogs. The New West and the Delta Police Force, like I say, we've gotten this indication now that maybe they have a different method of training. You know, to compare the statistics, in Vancouver alone, over the last 2 years, there have been over 140 people sent to the hospital by police dog. That's the number one use of force that's leading to serious injury. In New West and Delta, there's been one reported hospitalization due to police dog. That is just such a gigantic variation that it would be crazy for us not to take a closer look at that and to ask that question. Are they doing something different here that is preventing, you know, this insane use of force? And can the Vancouver Police Department and the RCP learn from it?
How did the Vancouver Police Department respond when you launched the lawsuit?
They were very defensive. And before we launched the lawsuit, there was also a policy complaint that we had started when Mr. Filippo came to us last summer. And we had really tried to engage with the Vancouver Police Department. We tried to work behind the scenes and say to them, you know, we're looking at these numbers, we're seeing these people come through our doors with these injuries that we don't see as necessary. A lot of them are innocent. A lot of them are youths. You know, what are you going to do about this? And we were actually very hopeful that we thought if we approached it this way, the department would take a look at it and they would realize that their numbers were way out of line with other departments in other countries, and they would at least take some kind of action. Just this January, they came back with their report, and personally, I was a little surprised to find how dismissive it was. You know, we're used to being dismissed. We're a nonprofit society. We're seen by a lot of the police as being a radical organization. Honestly, I think sometimes just for being there to criticize the police, that's the reality we face. But we felt, and we had gotten indications from other sources, that we were on the right track with this. And I think the department really had the option of dealing with it in that manner. They chose not to. In their report, they really dismissed all of our concerns. They said that they stood by their dog squad, and I got the impression that there's a very much a reluctance in Vancouver to do any changes or to make the dog squad change at all because they have such seniority. They've been around for so long. So you've got this entrenched mentality, this entrenched kind of style of training, and they gave us a clear message that they weren't going to switch it just because we thought they would. So based on that reaction, we decided the next, you know, rational course was to litigate it and to bring it into the court system and ask a judge, you know, this is the way it is, this is the way it could be. You know, are you going to give a direction to the department that maybe they need to change? And the consequence being, if they don't change, you know, they're going to have to start paying these people that they've sent to the hospital and compensate them for using excessive force.
And what kind of changes to the dog policy do you think are needed and that you can win through this court case?
Well, we're asking for four specific things in the long run. They mirror, in a lot of ways, the reforms that have happened across North America in other jurisdictions. And yeah, I think it's a step towards what I would say is the most progressive form of dog deployment, which you see in places like Europe and Australia and New Zealand, where the dogs are very limited in how they're used. In the States, for example, you have a situation where, number one, I think our biggest complaint is that the dogs, they should be seen as a specialty force. They shouldn't be seen as your average police officer. The dogs are being deployed what I would call, in a way, that are first responders. So in Mr. Filippo's case, and the same with Mr. Evans, it seemed like the only real reason why a dog was used was because that just happened to be a member of the dog squad that was closest at the time when the call came into 911. That's an irrational way of using force. And so we want a limitation placed on the department that says members of the dog squad should not be first responders. They should be called to a scene if it's determined that the use of a dog is necessary to track someone or if you have a suspect that's hiding and the dog needs to bring them out of hiding. That's when the dog squad should be deployed. In addition to that, you know, we think there needs to be analysis done of the crime that's been committed and whether or not it's a serious enough offense to warrant the use of the dog. If you've got somebody, and we've had so many stories come through our doors, people being bitten for doing the smallest of things, shoplifting a sandwich, vandalism of a sign, someone put silly string on a police car in Squamish, and as a result, that police officer who just happened to be with the dog squad released his dog on the boy. there's so many instances where the dogs have been used for such small minor crimes, and the potential for this life-changing and life-debilitating injury is really present. So we think there should also be limitations on just when they're deployed. It needs to be a serious offense. And then the biggest change is how they're trained. We have this adversarial method of training that results in a bite every time. And what we're suggesting is that we start looking at alternative methods. And maybe it's New Westminster and Delta and the way that they train. Maybe it's an international training model, or maybe it's the one that's deployed in the States the most, which is Bark and Hold.
And where are things at right now in the lawsuit?
Well, the lawsuit is just starting. We just filed it a few weeks ago, and the city hasn't actually gotten us a reply yet, so we're waiting to hear from them on what they're going to be arguing legally. You know, the lawsuit itself is going to take a couple years at least. That's just how the court process works. It's a long and drawn-out, thoughtful process. So we'll still be working in the meantime on various other things. There's provisions in the Police Act which suggest that the use of force can be reviewed by the government, and so we'll definitely be lobbying the government to take a position here and maybe to take a closer look at it. Hopefully when the Independent Investigations Office opens up, this is the kind of serious injury that they might be interested in taking a look at. So we'll definitely be lobbying for an investigation from them. And there is supposed to be an internal review of the RCMP's use of dogs, which resulted and was requested after that 16-year-old boy was bitten. And then it will be conducted by New Westminster. So we'll be keeping an eye out on that, and we'll be seeing what recommendations are made. And certainly it seems like right now there's a realistic possibility that New Westminster will be making some recommendations for changes. And if we agree with those, then we'll be asking that they happen in Vancouver as well.
Well, I wish you the best of luck in the suit and the campaign.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Douglas King. He is a lawyer with the policing campaign at Pivot Legal Society.